Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Idra Nowe, author of her debut novel, Ways to Disappear. Idra's poetry collections include Exit Civilization, The Next Country, and Clarice the Visitor, all are award-winning. She writes for the New York Times, NPR, Slate, and the Paris Review. She's also translated the work of several Brazilian authors, most recently, Clarice Lispector's The Passion According to G.H. She teaches in the creative writing program at Princeton, but has also taught at Columbia, NYU, Fordham, and Bard. I was talking the other day with Atish Tashir about his new book, The Way Things Were, and I said something like, you know, Atish, your books are all so concerned with language. And he goes, yes, Sam, pretty much I would be out of a job if they weren't. And and this book is about language, too, because in good part, it turns and deals with the arduous task of turning meaning into meaning through the medium of language. Translation has always been difficult for me, one, because I speak only English, and two, because I thus have no way of knowing whether a translation is good or not. I once asked a German professor whether my translations that I had of Hermann Hesse's works were good, and he goes, how the hell should I know? Because there would be no reason for him to read them in English. So to end this introduction, which is always hard for me to do, I want to read this quote, which is somewhat lengthy, by Borges, because it describes, I think, Idra, her book, and her poetry pretty well. And this is what he said. The task of art is to transform what is continuously happening to us, to transform all these things into symbols, into music, into something which can last in man's memory. That is our duty. If we don't fulfill it, we feel unhappy. A writer or any artist has the sometimes joyful duty to transform all that into symbols. These symbols could be colors, forms, or sounds. For a poet, the symbols are sounds, and also words, fables, stories. Poetry, the work of a poet, never ends. So with that, Idra, welcome and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So Ways to Disappear. Before I summarize the novel, why don't you summarize the novel?
Well, I love that quote from Borges, and this book definitely felt to me like a joyful duty. I really enjoyed working on it, and I think it's about a translator, but I think it also became a joyful duty to describe what it's like to travel as a woman and the particular perils for women when traveling alone. Because I've traveled all over the world as a writer and as a translator, and just, you know, as a curious person. And in the novel, Emma, the protagonist, is acutely aware, you know, of the predator stare of a hat vendor when she goes into a store alone, or even when she's in a hotel and she's walking, you know, to her room. So, you know, there's a lot of moments where she's aware of being a woman in a context that she doesn't really understand.
But the cool thing about it is it's almost like a 30s screwball novel in the sense that nothing really phases her, you know. She's got all this possible horrible things happening to her, including the loss of various appendages, and I'll just deal with this. And it's like, and that's why some of the reviews have talked about this novel using words like hilarity, which
I have to say, I laughed out loud.
I was just gonna say the same thing
writing it. I had such a good time writing it, and if a scene didn't make me laugh or make me feel that I was doing something that felt risky and exciting, then I just deleted it. I just got rid of it. You know, I think maybe because I came from poetry, I'm happy to delete and try something again. I think that's what makes writing joyful, is to know that if something doesn't work, you can just do something else and try a different kind of adventure. So I love that part of it.
Well, that's the other thing that's cool about the novel, because it's kind of a mystery. You want to call it kind of a comedy, but it's also kind of, okay, this is the way language works, and this is what it takes, you know, because it has to be considered somewhat autobiographical, whether it is or not. And this is what it takes to take words and say, well, I changed this word because I thought, well, you know, a man's desire, you know what I'm going to say. What's the quote?
Yes, a question of where it's something that he, you know, can't deny or won't deny. And I was definitely investigating that. And also, I think those cultural differences. I mean, part of the reason why I loved living in Brazil and translating Brazilian literature was that I found the spontaneity in Brazilian literature and music, and Brazilian music also, and an openness to surprise. It just really appealed to me. And when I wasn't living there anymore, I missed it. And so writing a book set in Brazil was kind of a way to go back.
Which is nice.
It was nice, especially writing it in the winter.
Yeah, I know. You do that too. You go 106 degrees here, 30 degrees in Pittsburgh. And then which kind of pissed me off because I'm freezing my ass off and I realize, yeah, I think. But then when you get there, you know, it's like some say the world, wind and fire, some say an ice, you know. It's like
yes.
when you're in one, you want to be in the other one. So what was really funny was when I was reading your translation of Clarice's The Passion According to G.H., I didn't know anything about her. So I had no idea that she wrote it in 1964 and she had been dead for 30 years. And then in your translator's note, you talk about how you wish you could talk to her when you translated so you could get an idea maybe if she could help you. But then that reminded me because you talked about how the young woman who was in love with Clarice wanted to go and talk to her and she agreed to meet her. And then Clarice sits there and stares at the woman, says nothing, and leaves. And then that reminded me of your description of Beatrice at times, right?
Yes. Yes, there's definitely a shadow there. He has a very astute reader. Thank you for reading the book with such care. I'm so honored. Yeah, there's definitely a shadow in the book. But I think also there's a shadow, but she's definitely a creation of my own imagination, who I think was in some ways both, you know, this writer who I had made up in my mind, but also became this version of me a little bit because I, you know, have a spouse who travels a lot, so I'm often alone with my two small children and right at night on my couch after putting my children to bed. And I think I was kind of seeing myself, as writers do, from a distance. Like, who are you when you're not being, you know, a mother and you're not just being, you know, a person on the street? You're this person writing something in your house, and it's this whole other identity, and you can escape the definitions that you have during the day. I mean, I think that has become, as I got older, a really appealing part of being a writer, is that other things feel fixed, but what I do as a writer is fluid, and I can come up with anything I want. I love that freedom.
Tell your husband that he's not like Miles.
He knows. He was the inspiration for Marcus.
So. Oh. So he's incredibly hot?
Well, I think so, of course, but that wouldn't be objective, I guess.
Well, does he have those muscles going down his trunk? You know what I'm talking about.
No. I mean, everything in the book is in some ways, you know, sort of a caricature. I was definitely playing, he's from Chile, not from Brazil, but I think I was playing, you know, with establishment genres, the mystery genre and the thriller genre, and I was really wanted to play with what we expect from a mystery and what we expect from a thriller and what we expect, you know, just from, you know,
well, plus
general literature. And I wanted to surprise myself as a reader, too. So.
Well, it's also kind of a sexual romp.
It is a romp. It is, yeah. I mean, felt that way writing it.
I mean, like Marcus, he's not necessarily that interested in Emma, but she knows that it's going to happen, but he knows it's going to happen because it always happens.
You know, it's interesting. I have found that there's a kind of resignation that people learn to have when they live in a country where you're just really near violence all the time. And you kind of have to become conditioned to living with it. I mean, what are you going to do? So I think a lot of times people end up having a sense of humor about it because how else are you going to cope? So I think, you know, humor lets you get away with things. I think when you're funny, you can say really dark things and get away with it because you're sort of laughing through it. So I was really playing with that, too, like how humor can be a coping mechanism and that you can laugh about dark things and it can help you get through it. And that, I think, definitely is true when you live in a city where there's a constant threat of violence, but you have to joke about it. How else would you leave it out?
Yeah, well, actually, you do it really well in that one scene where she first meets if I pronounce it close to right, I'll be happy. Flamenguinho,
yes.
Okay, Guinho. When she first meets him and he starts, which reminds me actually of my brother, he starts belching like incredibly loudly. And then he does it again for good measure. But it's like, it's very funny, but at the same time, behind the belch is this threat, really nasty threat. And it's made perfectly clear at the same time. So you're kind of laughing and everyone in the bar is looking around at this guy. But at the same time, yeah, just like what you were just saying. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think writing Flamiguinho, who is the loan shark in the novel who sends all the threats, was probably my favorite part of the book. You know, which is funny. And people are like, well, who did you relate to most? And I was like, well, I didn't relate to the loan shark, but I really enjoyed writing about a loan shark. I think it was fun to play with the tropes of mystery and the tropes of a thriller and just sort of our notions of a loan shark, you know, because he's kind of like, you know, a character of a Coen Brothers movie in a way that he's threatening, but he's also absurd, you know. I mean, he's a ridiculous loan shark.
Yeah, he's like one of the murderers in Fargo.
Exactly. I mean, like, yes, he has a gun, but he's also burping in public. So, you know, what do you do with a guy like that? It's hard to know.
Well, you do a really good job because it's like, okay, yeah, it's kind of like Maltese Falcon, but it's also kind of like the Roadrunner. You know, it's like.
Exactly.
But it's like, and the other thing was really cool because this is just me, the reader, but like, when she has the dream that, you know, she's being tried and all these spectators are up there and her arms and legs are kind of vanishing, right?
Yes.
So I'm thinking, okay, that's The Magus by John Fowles, which I don't think it is, but that was what the book and the movie showed. But that was me as a reader just taking that. Because she says, I know it's from a book and a movie. So what book and movie was it from?
Well, you know, I just came up with that. I might have been an influence, but I think I was just coming up with it just from the notion of playing with the notion of disappearance in as many ways as I could within the novel, and how, you know, you can disappear as a friend, you can disappear as a daughter to your own parents, you can disappear as a partner, you can disappear as a translator, as a writer. So I wanted to see in every way that the characters, as they're dealing with the disappearance of Beatrice, they're also thinking of their own ways that they vanish to each other in the book.
Or there can be a knock at your door during certain times in South America where your father's there and there's a knock at the door and then your father's gone.
Or immigration services here in our own country.
Oh, God. Let's not start with that, please.
No, I'm just saying. I think it could happen to people anywhere.
It can. And it's very, very, very scary.
It's very scary, yeah.
But the other thing I want to keep hammering on you with regard to influence is when she climbs up the tree with her little suitcase and her Donovan cigars, which I love Donovan cigars, it's just like The Baron in the Trees by Italo Calvino.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, it's funny too because all my life, you know, I loved it. I love Italo Calvino, so I've read everything he's ever written. But then all the time I read it, since they're all translated by William Weaver, who I admire tremendously, I don't know who I'm reading. So you must know the feeling, right? I mean, you know the feeling that other people have, right?
Well, I think when you're reading a great translation, you're reading a recreation of that work in another language. Every act of creation, I think, is another layer of art. And I think that just makes reading a book even more exciting. In the same way that, you know, if you get to know somebody and you meet them, you know, let's say you meet them in a work environment, right? You're only getting to know one version of them. And then if you see them in their home, you might get to know another version of that person. It doesn't mean that one is less authentic than the other. It's just a different version. And I think that translations can be like that too.
Yeah, but you kind of, you picked the epigraph of your book and you picked it for a reason. And the epigraph is that Edmond Yabe's statement.
He's an Egyptian writer, yes.
Yeah, which is, for a time we became the same word. It could not last. And but that kind of belies what you're just saying, because I think for a moment, at least in my life, for a moment you can touch, but then it's like, this is what happens, I end up talking all the time.
But you know what, I think in a book that, you know, just the way, I think when you translate someone, in some ways it is kind of like a love affair, and that, you know, a really intense love affair can't last, because, you know, you can't sustain the intensity of being completely enamored with somebody. You know, there has to be some sort of argument. There has to be some sort of time where you retreat back to yourself. So I do think in the moment when you are translating someone or you're in an intense love affair that you do become this one being. And it can't last. It has to transform into something else, which it has some element of disappointment, which has some element of disillusion, which has some other relationship that comes in and becomes, you know, a complication. So I think in a way, yes, translation, it does seem in one moment you become one word. But like any relationship, any love affair, it has to transform into something else. And, because you just, who can keep up that level of intensity? It's impossible.
Well, it's funny, if there was a translator Olympics, if there was a translator Olympics, you translating the first few pages of The Passion According to G.H., I think you would win it, because there's not one object word in the first 20 pages. I don't even know how in God's name, I don't even know how in God's name you could become even close to being able to do that. It's not until there's a cockroach, and no wonder they call her Kafkaesque. There's not until a cockroach comes out that you can actually have a word of something. You know, there's.
I have to say, I was relieved when the cockroach appeared, because I think you have to picture it in your mind, and so then you can write it. But I also think something happens too. Maybe that, like, if I would go to the Translator Olympics, I think I would also want to get out of there and go back to the Writer Olympics too, because I'm very much both, and I think. When I was translating with the deadline and had that intense love affair with Clarissa Spector, I really missed my own voice, too. And so I think that drove me to keep going back to my own Brazil, the Brazil that I had experienced as an American traveling there, and do my own version of it with my own cockroaches, too. I missed that.
Well, and so did she in the book, because, Marcus comes up behind her on the balcony, and what are you doing? Oh, the notebook. And, she's writing in her notebook, and I don't know what she's writing in her notebook, but she's writing something.
Yeah, I love writing notebooks. Whenever I travel, I always take multiple notebooks with me. Sometimes I can't even read when I get back what I wrote, but I do think they make me see things more keenly when I'm on a trip, if I just, use written language. Because, of course, I take pictures, I have my cell phone with me, and I take pictures of everything, but I think I'm a word person, like that great
Definitely.
Quote you read from Borges. And so I think when I use written language and not visual language, and I write things down, it stays with me in a different way, and I think then it fuels things I write later, which definitely happened with this book.
I always forget that I want to write, and I always end up writing on the vomit bags in airplanes. And
well, sure beats writing on them than using them, I would say.
Sometimes I have to borrow other people's, because I do both sides. And then when I get home, I'm looking at it. What the hell is this all about? What am I writing?
But well, I'm so glad you brought that up. I was like, now if I run out of notebooks, I'll think of you and be like, well, I'll use Sam's trick and pull out one of the vomit bags. I mean, that would have helped for Em in the novel when she ends up vomiting over the edge of the boat. Captured by the Brazilian media for, vomiting in public and ends up in the paper.
And what's Marcus can kiss anybody he wants. What's he kissing some girl who just threw up for anyway?
I don't know. I think it's about the conquest. Isn't that true for almost everybody? I think.
Marcus doesn't need to conquer anyone. He can conquer anybody. Well, up to after a certain point, he can.
Right. Yes. After you've been kidnapped, things get a little more complicated.
Yeah, especially in this one. Yes. I'm pretty good at not doing spoilers because a lot of the reviews. Explain that incident clearly. I wouldn't do that.
I know. I was surprised. It's funny how people say, that it's a page turner and that it moves like a bullet. And then they gave away what keeps the bullet moving. And I was like, no, wait.
Yeah, I would never do that. Sometimes I forgot what the quote is about what you shouldn't say in a review. But anyway, I think some of them go too far. But
well, when I was working on the book, it was funny. I kind of had this image in my mind of, the mystery of the book, or the search for Beatriz, and it became almost like a laundry line. It was like this tight line, and then I could kind of hang my ideas on her, hang my characters and things that they wanted to do on that taut line, because once you have that plot line that keeps things really tight and moving, then you can kind of throw in anything you want, and I think that was where the fun happened, so I don't know how I would write a book again without a loan shark. It really made it so much more compelling for me, too.
That's interesting because I guess, as a translator, you get questions all the time from people who read your translations. But, I mean, do you feel like when you read a book that you're going to translate that it's important for you to get the sine wave, the curves of the plot line before you can go back then? Because, like, translating the G.H. book... you could just translate it word for word throughout, because it's the first.
Well, the thing is that I think you really have to, translate in units the same way that I think we think in units and that we write in units. And even when you're having a conversation, I think we don't usually think in words. You kind of think in units of like what I want to convey to this person who's not helping me with my plane ticket is the following. Like you're not, if you're at that ticket counter in an airport and your plane has been, permanently delayed and you need to get home, you're not thinking, I'm going to say this word, and this word. You're thinking, I'm going to tell this person, with the TSA, that if I don't get home, I'm going to stand up on this table and, lose it. And so I think you translate that way, too, where you're thinking in units. This next sentence has to convey this, and this has to convey that. So I think it's more working in units, which a lot of people, I think, assume it's a word-by-word thing. But it's the same way you would think when you're thinking in a conversation. But I always just translated writers that I would learn from and that I admired because I thought that they would feed my own writing. And I think it was important for me to translate Clarice Lispector when I did because I think I also had two small children and read her letters about what as a writer when she had two small children and how that affected her thinking and it affected mine. It was a really transformative experience. It came in the right time, and I think it definitely cast a shadow over this book.
What do you do when you are doing this and you're moving along like crazy and you go, oh, this is great, and then you come across a colloquialism, then you go, holy mackerel. You go, how am I going to take this colloquialism? Like in French, how when there's a last piece of bread on the plate and everybody wants it, but no one will take it. And I think in French it's translated as the morsel of shame. But there's no word for it. Okay, there's a perfect one. I don't know French either, but if that's what it was, a morsel of shame, but we don't have anything for that. We all know there's a plate, has a piece of cake on it. All of us want it, but no one will take it, so it sits there.
Well, because I think Americans are a little shameless about taking food, There is no shame. If there's food left on the table, if there's a piece of pie, somebody is going to eat it and laugh and say they don't want it to go to waste. Like, I just don't think we have shame about just gobbling things up. It's just a cultural difference, And I think that's, definitely true about writing a book that somewhere else. The interesting thing for me when I was working on this is how Emma's notion as an American traveling of what a threat is, she doesn't get it. She doesn't get what the threats are the way that, Mark Luthor or his sister Raquel would because they live there. And, I live in New York, but I also grew up in Pennsylvania. And the different threats that I was aware of growing up in outside Pittsburgh and Johnstown was very different than the kinds of threats that I was aware of when I lived in Brazil or when I lived in Chile or where I live now in New York. So I was really, having lived in different places and being aware, like you said, of these different notions of shame or fear, how do they play out in a conversation between people in Portuguese as opposed to a conversation in English? And sometimes they don't go, you got to figure out some way around them.
Yeah, but then you find yourself like drifting. I would think you would find yourself kind of like drifting away, and then you have to bring yourself back. I mean, it was
which
just,
is why I think humor is so handy. I think whenever I'm speaking another language and I was like, wow, like I said, this conversation is not quite conveying my sense of fear or shame the way I feel it as an American, as someone who grew up somewhere else. And then I think that's why you save yourself with a joke. It's like humor is really helpful that way, that if you can just make a joke about yourself, then it really gets you out of a sticky situation. I've done it so many times where I reach an impasse and I'll just say, well, how can I, say something funny and get out of this corner? One hopes. Doesn't always work, but it's certainly worth trying, I think.
True. It works in life. I mean, it works
it
forever.
It certainly works in life. Yeah, it works on the subway many times where someone like elbows me in the face on the subway and I'll be like, excuse me, it's as opposed to choosing an argument, to choose a joke, I think often, can make for a more joyful duty as a writer.
And just like in translating, you have to really quickly gauge your audience. Like, okay, if I say this to this guy, is he going to knife me or is he going to laugh back at me? You have to make it pretty clear.
And you may judge wrong. It's hard to know. It's hard to know sentence by sentence. But I think that's the interesting thing that I learned through translation as a writer is that the thing that seems like the obvious next choice often isn't. And that you reach an impasse and the word for shame in French or the word for shame in English or in Portuguese doesn't really have the same feel. And so maybe the right word isn't shame. Maybe it's something else. you know, and the way to get to convey it is to just use another word altogether. And I think that helped me working on this book, because I was playing with these establishment genres of the mystery and the thriller, but I wanted to play with them. So I was trying to sort of turn them on their head and do something else with them.
It was funny how Beatriz. It's funny how her titles are also goofy, you know, but they're also very funny.
The warm green sound of your sleeve. Yes, that one was really funny. Some of it. And have you tasted the butterfly?
That was my favorite. But it's which also reminded me of Nabokov too. But I don't know why. And then
absolutely, it was absolutely Nabokov influence because of Lepidopter.
Yeah. And then so then, after she's missing, after someone dies or goes missing, they become very valuable commodities. So the new covers and titles have that one, especially the one you talk about it twice, with the cutlery on the cover. And owning a bookstore, you know, everybody says you can't judge a book by its cover, but everybody, every single person who comes in there judges every book by its cover, which is why publishers get to pick it generally. Oh, who picked your cover? Your cover is beautiful.
Oh, well, thank you. I love the cover, too. I love the suitcase on it. I love that it has this one sleek image. And maybe it became a self-fulfilling prophecy because I had come up in the book about having a cover with a sleek image. And then I got a cover with a sleek image. So I wonder if every time I write a book from now on, I'll always come up with my dream cover within the book. So hopefully the end cover of the book will also be the imagined cover I put into the book. But I think I am fascinated by covers. I mean, the interesting thing when you look at books that are published in different countries is how the same book in a different language can have a radically different cover, especially Italian covers. I'm always fascinated what happens to books when they get translated into Italian. I'm so curious to see what the Italian cover for Ways to Disappear will look like. We'll see. I haven't seen it yet. And the German cover, I'm excited to see what the German cover of this book will be, because thinking about how these things change, you know, depending on cultural notions of what a sleek cover looks like. I think in the cover I made up in the book has this silverware on it, and the editor says he thinks of it as being sort of sleek but delicious. And I think what is a sleek but delicious feel is very different for a German meal than an Italian meal or a Brazilian meal. It would be a really different kind of meal.
Right, and he's looking at it like a steak.
And I'm a vegetarian, so my notion of a delicious meal never has a steak in it.
But it is funny. I never really thought about covers being translations of covers. But, I mean, obviously that's true. But, and even the British covers of, at least we get a lot of the British titles as well, and they are completely different. So let me ask you a question. What about the other guy up in the tree? What was he doing there? I mean, what's the point of putting up in the tree and getting rid of him like that?
Well, you know, I love this idea of coming with a writer who had these wild stories that I didn't have to finish, you know? And I'm so fascinated. I'm going to have to ask you to give me exactly where you got that Borges quote from, because I think the joyful duty of an author is that when you put something out there, you have to take it all the way. But when I made up this author and she had these wild stories, they were just snippets of her story, so I didn't have to take them all the way. And I think that kind of emboldened me to come up with ever wilder stories that were such a pleasure to write, because I didn't have to write the whole story, and so I could put that prison warden up in a tree and leave him there. You know, I didn't have to get him back down like I had to do my own author.
That's pretty funny. Well, that was the other thing that happened to me as a reader, too. While I'm reading it, I'm thinking, wait a minute, am I reading something like The Neverending Story, where you have to give the everlasting princess a new name? Is this a book about a book? Is this book really something? Maybe this book is something she's translating.
Maybe it is a Rio de Janeiro version of 1001 Nights. But I mean, I went to that island. A lot of the things in the book are, you know, were about places that fascinated me when I lived in Brazil, or when I've gone back for different events and things that I've gone back to Brazil. And that island where the prison is has these really wild trees, and I wanted to go and see those ruins of that prison. And there was a monsoon, and I did get stuck in my hotel for days and was sitting there with, you know, itching from mosquito bites, trying to walk up the window. So all of that definitely came from life.
Yeah, the mosquitoes. Yeah, even inside the netting. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Well, it always happens that there'll be like a mosquito net over a bed in a hostel or in a hotel, and there's a hole in the mosquito netting. And then you're like, well, what's the point?
There is no point.
there is no point. And then if you try and get out of the mosquito netting to, you know, go and get a glass of water, and you get, like, caught in the mosquito netting, and it's dark, and you're wrapped up like a mummy, it's very confusing.
You know, it's funny, when her daughter comes to the island, the place with the yellow umbrellas, and is there talking, we don't hear them. Reader doesn't hear them. And it goes back to this idea of the author, you know, being quiet, not conveying a lot of information. I don't know what they said, but it seemed like it was more than she had ever said to her daughter in her life. But then she goes, well, I'm not going to give any spoilers.
Well, you know, when I wrote that scene, that was a moment in the book that took me a long time to figure out, because the whole book is about this woman who's vanished,
right,
and how she became seen in her absence. And I think that often happens with women or people or even with men who maybe have jobs or roles that we don't have a lot of visibility to them. You know, that maybe it can happen, you know, with somebody who works in the building where you live or in a school or something like that, that you don't really see them until they're not there. And I think that was definitely true for Beatrice, that she's not seen until she vanishes. And her own editor says, you know, authors often become famous when they die, but maybe it's even better to vanish, especially if you're a woman writer. And in her absence, I mean, if you look at the writer Elena Ferrante, we don't see her, we don't hear her. And I think that's part of the reason why we can't stop reading her, because in her absence, what we have is her work. And so I think that was why I decided, which I wrote long before the Elena Ferrante extravaganza happened, was how in this writer's absence, and in her absence to her own children, how she would be heard. And once I came up with that silence and it felt like it was the center of the book, I kind of wanted the reader to fill that silence for themselves and not have me fill it for them.
Yeah, but what you did was, there was something of substance said between the two women.
Yes, I hope so, yes.
Well, if you don't know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there was something of substance said and led to the boat going away with one person rather than two, and whatever it was, which brings me to the question of how do you know about and what do you think about internet gambling?
Well, you know, I think with the thing about the internet gambling happened because I was a bit fascinated with how you online, you know, you can look at anything or do anything, and some people get caught, like, and you know, Anthony Weiner did, but a lot of people don't. It can go on for years that you have this whole other life online and nobody knows about it, and it's this silent life, and it can go on and get worse or get better, and you never have to account for it unless, of course, you start getting some debt notices in the mail. And so I was just wondering about that as sort of just part of our century, you know, this notion of online life and secret online lives and how many people have them and how the people who think they know them the best don't know who they are online.
Yeah, and it's only going to get worse. You just have to come to a point where culturally I think it'll be that we all know we have no privacy and we'll just act that way, whether what was shame, the word shame again, what was shameful no longer becomes shameful. It's just, we know you're all doing this, we're all doing it too, and we'll just let it be.
But we spend more and more time on computers and phones all the time. And so in that time that you spend on the computer or the phone, the question is, who are you? Are you the same person you are when you're not on your phone, or are you someone else? And do the people who know you when you're not on your phone know that person, or do they know someone else? And so I just think that whole notion of shifting identities and how we define ourselves online and how we define ourselves at work, and how you can kind of shift or hide identities depending on where you are. It's a really crazy time we're in. I mean, I think there's a lot of opportunities to redefine yourself.
Well, it sounds exactly like the first few pages of The Passion of G.H.
Absolutely. I think that's why I love that book. It's one of my favorite books, because she really reckons with who you are. And I do think there can be a feeling like you can be anyone online. But as you said, I think we're realizing that the fantasy that you can be someone else online and it won't catch up with you in real life, that it is nothing more than a fantasy, and that eventually it all, you know, comes to a hold.
Yeah, I think that's true. Even if it's through the NSA, for God's sakes. you know?
Exactly. Yeah, somebody's going to get a hold of your phone, even if Apple refuses, you know, access to it. We don't know what will happen with that. But I think, you know, for this novel, that was definitely something I was curious to write about, is what happens when you have an online identity you tell nobody about, and all of a sudden it becomes their problem. You know, what do you do with that? Maybe you climb into a tree. I don't know. What else can you do?
Well, I think it gets to a point where, yeah, you have to either say, I'm going to live with the consequences of my actions, or I'm simply going to walk off and exit. And that's what
you do. Yeah, to get the best cigar you can and grab your suitcase and just take off. I mean, you know, I think that's... But I wonder what it was like to go through a whole life, especially as a parent, without being able to go online and get out of your house in like a millisecond. It's really freeing, you know. I love to look at plane tickets and you know, think about, you know, where I would go if, you know, I didn't have to work the next day or people didn't have school. It's really freeing, and I think there's all those kinds of internet freedom. I mean, that's what novels do, too, that they give you that kind of freedom. You can open a book in the middle of winter set in Brazil, and then you're there. And as a writer, that's the fun part, is that you can just set a story anywhere, and then for the next 3 years of your life, you get to live there.
Yeah, and also it's like, and I'm kind of talking against my bookstore now, but if you read this on an iPad or a Kindle or something like that, and you press a word, because it's a book where, you know, if you're American, some of these words aren't going to mean... You're not going to know what they mean, and if you press the word, you get the Wikipedia definition, you get the dictionary definition, and you can get the translation if you want, and that's amazing. When I was a kid, I'd have to go back to the World Book and, you know, search through it for hours to figure out what you meant when you talked about a certain Brazilian dish or something like that.
Absolutely, but I also think there's something, I mean, maybe because I'm an old school reader, where, you know, I think within the context of the novel, everything's there within the paragraph. You could look it up if you wanted to know more, if you were curious. We could also just get caught up in the story and keep going and realize that you're actually learning much more than you thought you would. It was interesting to come across a couple reviews of the book saying that you know, you just end up kind of learning things about Brazil and Portuguese that you don't even realize until, you know, it's come up a bunch of times. Like the word embora in Portuguese means to leave. You know, embora just basically means I'm leaving. And you don't have to say where. You don't have to say when you come back. And we don't really have a phrase like that in English. You know, you can't just say, I'm going out without saying I'm going out for the paper or I'm going out for, you know, to fix my phone or I'm going out, I'll be back later. Like, we don't really allow to just say heading out in the same way.
When Scott ill-fated expedition to the South Pole and they were in the tent like just 20 miles from the depot where the food was and they were all dying, one of the guys who had really bad frostbite and knew he was a goner, he got up, being British, he got up and he said, I'm going outside for a bit. I may be sometime.
Now, I mean, you know, I may be sometime, because I think there's, you know, something in English that we have an expectation to be told when you'll come back. Whereas in Portuguese, he could have just left and said, vou embora. And everyone would be like, okay, I'm just heading out.
2 points that are kind of technical, but you use them throughout. One is the interstices between the chapters where you have a definition of a word. And the number one definition is the actual definition. And the second is a definition that you include that describes what's going on in that transition period between the last chapter and the next. How did you come about that technique? And it's also funny, too.
Oh, thank you. I think because I was moving between these different narrators and I was trying to, you know, play with the genre of mystery and thrillers, but I also was playing with tone, that throwing in the definitions and the radio dispatches and the emails and everything else I threw in, I was playing again with this notion of definition, and that the Beatriz and disappearing was sort of escaping the definition that her editor imposed on her and the definition that her translator imposed on her. And maybe even how she defined herself and, you know, coming to a head when, you know, her online poker problems manifest. But I think with the definitions, it was kind of playing again with that notion of definition in general. As I think it kind of became a larger and larger theme in the book, is how people define and redefine each other and themselves online and in real life.
And then you have as something happens, El Globo, this like the New York Post, this newspaper that you've created and radio show and I guess pretty much all the media outlets comments in a salacious way about what's going on. And it pushes the story along, but it also gives an added, I don't know, what's the quality? It gives an added is it satirical, I guess?
I think it was. I think there's funny updates. But, I mean, that's the great thing about radio, and it is kind of like a New York Post kind of feel to it, that, you know, they're really great. They're funny. I mean, also there's radio shows in the U.S. that are like this, too. But, you know, they kind of poke fun at the frequency of crazy things that happen in a city over the course of a day. A lot of crazy things happen. And so I think that's what I was playing with when I started putting more writers into the trees and having them disappear. Some of them to far worse fates, of course. But
yeah, and I know. And the Globe's always going like, and if you're walking along underneath some trees today, better be careful that, you know, an author doesn't fall on your head or something like that. There's always some tagline like that, which is really funny also. But, you know, I just think that all these elements together, and the thing, and also I can always tell whether I really like a book and whether a book is really good is because I'll remember these characters' names probably for a long time, if not the rest of my life. And it's not loaded with characters, but you can pretty much, you pretty much have the relationships in hand, especially like when you realize in that one moment that Beatrice is, unlike what Emma thinks, she's writing her son and daughter into her novels, but not in such a way that anyone would know. That was kind of cool.
Well, I was curious about that. When I was a younger writer, I knew that I didn't want to write about motherhood or about my children, didn't want to be boxed in. I would have been horrified if I thought I would ever be on a radio program and mention the fact that I even had children. I would worry what anyone would think of me. But they take up such a big part of your life. And I reached a point where I was like, well, that is ridiculous. If anyone would take me as a writer less seriously because I happen to be female or because I happen to have children, then that's not my problem. And I realized that it's dangerous to hide parts of yourself from your writing. And it's dangerous not to bring your whole life to your work.
Yeah, she's an interesting woman, and I wonder what made her tick, you know?
Yeah, I did too, and I think that definitely came from trying to understand where I was, you know, as with all my different roles as, you know, as a writer and as a professor and commuting all the way to Princeton and coming back home and then, you know, getting dinner together with all these people and writing this book and had my translation deadline. I was like, every day I was, you know, six or seven people once. None of them was an online poker fanatic, but... there wasn't, only because there was not enough time.
You don't know if any of them were, but...
Well, I haven't revealed it yet.
Anyway, I love the book. I think it's great. And, you know, as I said, I own our bookshop, Wellington Square Bookshop, and the book's already on the front table, and it's a staff pick, so...
Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be on the show.
Thank you. And I will send to your publicist, it's actually an interview on YouTube, which is a beautiful interview with Borges, and I'll send you that so that you'll have that long quote. There's a lot of good stuff in there.
Thank you. And thank you for reading the book so carefully.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Thanks so much. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. We were talking with Idra Nove. Ways to Disappear, her latest novel, which was published in February by Little Brown and Company. It's a story about a translator, which Idra also is, in addition to being a poet and a novelist. It's about a translator whose author, a Brazilian author, goes missing. And so she, as the translator, comes from Pittsburgh down to Rio to try and find out where her author has gone. And then all hell breaks loose. And like I say, it's a combination of a mystery and a thriller and a comedy and a literary kind of thriller too, and it's chock full of all kinds of different techniques. You can almost see the poetry in it as well, and her collections of poetry are excellent and way more accessible than you would normally think poetry might be. In any event, she was a wonderful guest, and I'm so glad to have her with us. And as usual, we have a really good lineup of people. I'm just looking at it now. Oh yeah, so. Upcoming, we have Peter Ross Range. He discusses his latest book, which is 1924, The Year That Made Hitler, which was the year he was in jail and he wrote Mein Kampf. But when you look at the pictures in the book, he had a really nice jail cell. I mean, it was like my living room. So I don't know why that was his struggle. Yeah, you got to look at the pictures. Anyway, and also Fergus Bordewich, who's talking about his timely release, The First Congress, How James Madison, George Washington, and a Group of Extraordinary Men Invented the Government. At least the government we have now. I don't know whether we'll have it then. So we have a bunch more we're lining up now. I'm not going to give away any more hints because we haven't locked them in tightly. But we have lots of good things coming all the way through the middle of this year, which I can't believe is upcoming. And thank you, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader.